Oh, you are Jacob Fry, are you not? And Miss Fry?
We're at a disadvantage, sir.
Karl Marx, much like you, I am an activist of sorts.
You've got the look of a man who wants something.
Indeed. You've done more for London citizens lately than any endeavor has accomplished in a decade. But those citizens were already well provided for. I challenge you both to help those who really need your assistance, the working people.
An interesting challenge. We accept.
Shouldn't we at least talk about these things for... Sod it. We accept.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Marx at Play. This is the first episode of a podcast where we look at Marx and Marxism in various aspects of culture, be it in films, games, songs, and anything else that we can find it in. My name is John.
And my name's Jamie.
And hopefully by the end of this show, you'll have a better understanding, as hopefully we do, about where Marxist ideas coincide with the gaming world in particular. The very first episode here, we're going to be covering a game, which is a novelty for me because I don't understand them very well. But fortunately, Jamie does. So we should have some fun with this.
So, or claims to.
Well, okay. Yeah, you've got good cred on this one though, haven't you, mate? Let's be fair. More than me. Okay, so the game we're going to be talking about is Assassin's Creed Syndicate. Now, for those of you who are already familiar with this particular genre of game, you're probably going to know why we're talking about this one, but just in case you're not, we'll explain that it's mainly because there's a very, very specific Marxist element to this, and that is Karl Marx is in it. He's got an actual, not really a starring role, is it? I suppose it's more supporting cast role.
Yeah, an important cameo.
Yes, very, very, very special. Anyway, I'll just tell you a couple of things about the game itself. This is an action adventure video game. It's the ninth part of the Assassin's Creed franchise, and it was developed by Ubisoft Quebec. It was released in October 2015 for PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and on the PC. The storyline follows a fictional history within real world history, and it takes place in the city of London. The assassin characters are said to fight for liberty against the Templars, who wish to impose order, whatever that means. Such fights for power appear quite central to the game, as best I can tell. Bearing in mind, I've only looked into this and not actually played a single one of these games, but there you go. The game was pretty well received at the time. It got nominated for some awards, but some criticised the repetitive aspects of the gameplay, like side missions, stuff like that. Most research I've done of the game does not say all that much about Marx's appearance, so we are going to address that with this show right here, because we're going to say a lot about it. So, Jamie, you want to start on this. Where do you want to start with this? Kind of the overall game itself, the storyline, all that sort of stuff. Go for it.
Yeah, so I think, I obviously wanted to play this game because it has Marx in it. And so that was my route into it, is thinking, you know, how on earth did Marx turn up in this game? Because as you say, it's a long-running series. It has this kind of sci-fi premise of, you know, this guy plays through his ancestors' memories and it gives them a chance to kind of to look at all these different historical periods. One of them that's quite good, before we get onto the Marx one, is there's one set in the kind of golden era of piracy. Mm-hmm. And you get to run around, you know, stealing British ships and so on. So there are, you know, there are some other radical themes hidden amongst some of them too. But you know, of course, it doesn't get too much into some of the more exciting stuff about pirates and focuses mainly on assassinating people, hence the title Assassin's Creed. But I mean, what I really like about it is you could pass Marx by in the game. You know, you don't have to play through the mission, but it's a kind of, you know, I always wonder with these things, like, who was it who made the decision to put him in? You know, was it one of the story writers or a developer who thought this is a good chance to kind of sneak Marx into the game, or you know, how did it come about? And I guess some of that's like lost history, isn't it? you know, will probably quite hard to uncover that. But for me, what's interesting about it, and I write about this in the book I wrote about Marxism and video games, is I think there's a really kind of, there's a really interesting and kind of subversive side to what the encounter with Marx is about. You know, that he gets you to do, you know, the first mission is running, helping him run away from some cops, which, you know, we know from some of Marx's letters to Engels, they got up to no good sometimes on pub crawls and had to duck out from the cops. So there's a bit of kind of historical accuracy there. But the bit that I really like is Marx gets you to go and steal some factory records. And so what we see in the game is Marx kind of, you know, unfortunately, I don't think it's true that he got assassins to go and steal factory records. You know, he spent a lot of time reading parliamentary reports, but it shows a side of Marx who was interested in how things were produced, what conditions were like in the factory. So for me, it's a kind of really interesting starting point for thinking about radical politics, how, you know, how games are made, how stuff was being made in Marx's time. It becomes this kind of jumping off point, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that, when we've discussed this in the past, that's the thing that caught my attention, which is the kind of appearance of this character who, as we know, still excites quite a lot of reaction, even 200 plus odd years after he's not been with us anymore. But he's as you say, he's there. I didn't realize you could just pass him by, actually. That is interesting. So you don't necessarily have to do the mission. You kind of have to choose to go and take part. Is there a different variety of, can you say no to any of these missions?
I mean, this is the thing, and I think when you said the criticism of this game getting a bit repetitive, is this genre of game is one where there's a core storyline you can play through, but then there's like a huge amount of additional things you can do. So these little side storylines, like the one with Marx. And I think actually when I was playing through to try and find the Marx mission, I thought that, I think there's one with Darwin or some other bearded man, and I thought, yes, I finally reached the one with Marx. And then he starts talking about not what you would expect Marx to, and then I figured out, oh no, that's actually not Marx, that's Darwin I've met first. So, you know, there's all these different side missions and things to collect and so on. And you know, this is kind of a critique of these games, is that they become so big and sprawling that, you know, they're filling these worlds with things to do, because that's what they think keeps people playing games, you know. So you could miss Marx in the game. I mean, I think he's kind of pointed out to you as a, you know, this is trying to bring the world alive, you know, and it's Victorian London, so factory workers are kind of a pretty key part of it, you know.
Yeah, and that's I suppose the part that interests me. Just for note, by the way, I think both Charlies are in this game, both Darwin and Dickens, if I remember rightly.
I think you're right. Yeah.
I read that somewhere. So it's this idea of you being engaged with this major political figure and his actions, where you can attach a degree of fantasy. Obviously, the entire game is a fantasy. But like you say, also the idea that we like, but we have no proof of this, that he was getting people to break into factories to basically do industrial espionage. And or you can pick up different aspects of who the man really was, what he was really talking about, what he really wrote about, and whether that, I suppose, takes you off to find out more. Which I suppose is kind of similar to if you watch a documentary or a biopic of somebody. And it's whether or not it sparks enough interest in you to want to go and read more or find out more. And I like the fact that this is, I mean, my views of gaming, we're not going to get into those because we don't have an argument. But as you know, generally speaking, I'm not massively interested. But yeah, I am intrigued. I'm intrigued, I suppose, what I'm trying to say, that they would put this in here. Why they put this in here, we'll get to as we discuss this. I want to talk a little bit more about a couple other things before we get to that. But yeah, so you're wandering around London, you're doing little missions, you're rowing with the various people, you're rowing with the police. I did note one thing, actually, that it does pitch socialists and anarchists against each other, which I was ground my teeth a little bit on that one, which I'm sure is accurate, though, to be fair. Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a kind of interesting, what I find interesting about the portrayal of Marx is, you know, as I think we've talked about before, I have a kind of a particular interpretation of Marx, which, you know, lots of people see Marx as somebody that wrote Capital and, you know, did this from a kind of, you know, I guess a kind of like slightly abstracted position of, you know, writing these tomes of books and so on. But later in Marx's life, he writes this call for a workers' inquiry, where he tries to get factory workers to send stuff into him, and has this real kind of interest in trying to get workers' perspectives to try and understand not only capitalism, but like how we can go beyond capitalism. And so what I find interesting is someone who wrote the storyline for Marx portrays him as someone who's going out into the world, you know, trying to figure out working conditions in factories. And so that's the bit that is kind of fascinating, because it could have just been like, you know, you go to him when he's in the British Library writing, and you kind of miss it. But I mean, there is some stuff in the portrayal. So one of the missions after the exciting industrial espionage one, Marx goes on at you about how he's really anti-violence, and some mad anarchists are going to blow up Parliament, and like, will you stop them, because it'll screw up the workers' movement and so on. And you know, anyone who knows stuff about Marx and his writing on these things, he certainly wasn't a pacifist who called for non-violence. And so it's a kind of weird moment where, you know, you have this nice version of Marx being portrayed, which I think is quite a rare thing in popular culture, and then you have this pretty blunt, like, socialists are for Parliament, anarchists are for blowing stuff up moment that comes out, as you say. And you know, you can't support the anarchists and still finish the Marx mission. You know, you have to intervene. So the game doesn't give you much flexibility there, you know.
In looking into it, I got a bit of a sense that the Marx character puts over a very overt message about solidarity, which is good. But also they portray him as a bit more of a reformer than a revolutionary. I mean, have I read that right? Or
yeah, so I mean, a lot of that discussion is he's talking about how peaceful change is going to be what kind of gets the working people what he perceives they deserve and so on. So it's quite a kind of, you know, it's a very one-dimensional kind of perspective. And I guess that's what's kind of surprising about it, is like, whoever wrote it knew enough about Marx to know the stuff about factory reports, but then, you know, didn't take that one step further. I mean, you know, Marx had some pretty big debates with anarchists in the First International, but they weren't debates about should we hijack this coach load of explosives or not. And I guess, you know, this comes down to one of the issues with video games, isn't it, is, you know, they also have to be fun.
Yeah.
So, you know, Marx isn't asking you to go and sit in the library and read the factory reports with him. He's asking you to go off and, you know, knock out a guard and jump through a window and so on. So it's like, obviously not going to be, you know, totally accurate, you know.
It'd be like the most skipped mission in game history is the one where you have to go and sit and read for an hour.
Yeah. Hey, I'd play through it, but I realise that's a bit niche. You know?
I would too, but that's probably why we're making this show together. We're niche as anything. Let's talk, we'll come back to a little bit more of the actual cultural aspect of this, but I want to talk now about how the game was made and issues in the industry. Now, you have written a very large amount in your aforementioned book about this. Overall in the industry, I suppose, but I suppose specifically, you know, it's 2015. This is Ubisoft Quebec, who I know nothing about other than their name. What's going on in the industry at this point? And I suppose leading up to today, you know, what's changed, if anything?
So that's a good question. So what's changed is the scale of things is much bigger in the industry now. But a lot of the underlying issues are the same. So there has been a very long history in the video games industry of overwork, cultures of overwork. So in the industry, it's called crunch. So working extremely long hours in the run-up to the release of a game. So, I mean, I've spoken to people who've worked, you know, 70, 80, 90 hour weeks in the run-up to games being launched on what should be a regular full-time contract. So, you know, looking at like double, maybe even more hours. And a lot of this is because of how big these games are. You know, many of these games have marketing budgets bigger than a blockbuster film, for example. So, you know, if you're spending all that money as a big publisher like Ubisoft or EA, Electronic Arts, or whoever it is, like you want your game to be ready. And, you know, you're sending it out to a consumer base that are, let's say, not afraid to be critical of the kind of things that they're receiving. So you end up with these kind of huge pressures on deadlines and so on. But, you know, in a way, like Marx, when he's writing about factories, was quite familiar with this problem of overwork. Is if you force people to work more, you extract more from them. And because this problem is so widespread in the industry, we can't say it's like an accident where like somehow a manager forgets that they run out of time at every project. It's like institutionally built in that big projects will end up with this crunch time, essentially.
Yeah, there's a pretty horrible irony, I think, in this case to Karl Marx popping up in this game. In this world, has that got any better, really? I mean, that you can tell, I don't know, you know, like post publishing your book, how much more involvement you've had in getting info from people on this, but what's the deal? I suppose what I'm also saying is what's the kind of union position in the gaming world? Again, a little difficult, I suppose, to say because it's global, isn't it? There's so many different places, but I mean, is there anywhere where there's a decent bit of union representation coming up?
I mean, I think it's a good question because, you know, when we talk about this game being made in Quebec, or we talk about, like, you know, Grand Theft Auto is technically made in Edinburgh, but obviously these games aren't just made in that one place. You know, they're made all over the world with huge numbers of people. So, you know, Assassin's Creed will have had hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000+ people working on it. So these are, you know, these are big capitalist enterprises that are employing people all over the world, serious budgets and so on. And at the time that this game was made, there were no like visible active unions organizing in the sector. And I'm always cautious to say it doesn't mean that people weren't organizing unofficially or, you know, doing under the radar stuff. But the big change since then is over the last 2 years, there's been a kind of explosion of organizing in the video games industry. So starting in the US, and then there's been the formation of a union branch of the IWGB in the UK. There's a French trade union. There's now a trade union in South Korea. And there's worker networks kind of emerging across Europe, across other countries. So there's lots of exciting organizing beginning to happen. And, you know, much of this comes from crunch, from periods of overwork, but also shitty management practices, often involving, you know, harassment or equalities issues at work.
Yeah, that's something we've looked at quite a bit and in recent times, and it is an industry that I think has suffered in a lot of ways from effectively being ignored in regard, like much of the entertainment industry, I suppose, and no doubt this is an issue that will come up in the show as we go on, which is that it's not really considered to be work or not really considered to be real work, or there's a bit of a strange habit that everyone imagines that anyone, for instance, who works on a film set is getting paid ridiculous amounts of money for being there. And no doubt the games industry is exactly the same. People don't kind of see this, as you say, overwork. I mean, let's call it what it is. You know, crunch time is whipping people to a point of exhaustion to get your game out. It's pretty twisted. And I must say, your works were one of pretty much the first place I read about that. And I wasn't surprised when I read it, but I was a little bit taken aback by it. So yeah, I think that this is, I suppose, this is a good place to bridge into the next point I want to talk about, which is the actual playing of the game. Now, I know that in a manner of speaking, we can never really say what someone gets from playing a game. They might play this game, go through it, every historical figure in it without pausing for breath and not bothering to ever look up anything else about them. They might look into some of them. They might decide in the game to go and assassinate Karl Marx and then post their video of doing it on YouTube, which I've seen already. But it's the kind of position of what does it really mean in the real world? Because I don't consider, again, that's kind of a wider conversation here, but I'll try and keep it under control. What's the, you know, I don't believe in consumerism having any kind of political basis to it, really. I think it's actually kind of designed to kill political desire and interest in people. So I don't believe playing this game or choosing to play one with this character when this has any real political aspects to it. But am I wrong? What do you think?
No, I mean, you know, I agree. I mean, I think this is the kind of, you know, this is the issue with talking about culture, hey? How I interpret playing Karl Marx and how somebody else interprets playing Karl Marx are going to be very, very different. And I think, you know, the argument that I've tried to make about video games, which, I mean, we've talked about a number of times before, is, you know, I don't think getting people to play a game with Marx in is going to, you know, suddenly change people's politics. But I think on the left, like, we should have something to say about video games. Because if Marx is in a video game, or if a video game takes on a historical issue, or, you know, has some politics in the game, we should say something about it. Much like the left has said for, you know, generations about theater, about newspapers, about novels, about film, is these are, you know, consumer products like this, consumer culture is how some people make sense of the world. You know, how they work through ideas, how they get inspiration for things. And so, you know, I'm a fan of Stuart Hall's writing on culture. Is, you know, it's not where radical ideas are going to come from. It's not where radical ideas are going to, you know, build their base, but it's where issues around consent to what kind of system we live under, around ideology, it's where many of those things are thrashed out. And so we should have an argument about them because we want to build an alternative society. So, like, that battle for ideas is also, like, plays a role, much like how people engage with novels or theatre or so on in previous generations.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. There's all forms of culture we should have something to say about, especially when they either include or exclude people or ideas or certain aspects. I think that's absolutely right. Okay, so just a wider thing on the games itself, because I was looking at this, and it's interesting what you said earlier on about what I didn't understand about these games, which is that the it's based on a player, you know, playing through the lives of his ancestors.
It's way more convoluted.
Yeah, it would be. Keep it simple. I haven't got the brain for stuff like that. Okay, so basically he's kind of doing that, but which almost kind of seems like a comment on gaming itself, or in particular virtual reality. If I were to just take it at purely surface value, not looking any more into it than that, it seems to me like it's kind of a comment on that. And ultimately that's kind of my point, is I think that the kind of idea of playing a game like this, or a game I remember from the PlayStation 2 a long time ago called State of Emergency, where you sort of start riots and stuff. But it seems like it's a very safe, disconnected way, because you're not really in the real world. And the more that you're not in the real world, the more kind of detail, as you pointed out already, kind of detailed and convoluted this game actually gets. It feels a little bit more like it's a retreat from the real world.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with that. One of my ways that I like to retreat from the world when you have had a long week, or, you know, you've had loads of stuff on at work, or you've been involved in a really difficult campaign or whatever, is I like to read, I was going to say sci-fi novels, but I know that people who've seen the books that I read would label them trashy sci-fi novels, which is like totally a form of escapism, you know?
Yeah.
Why not? Like, you want to read about something happening somewhere completely different, and that gives you that bit of escapism that then means you can return, quote unquote, to the real world, you know, reinvigorated and so on. As I think the kind of increased number of people playing video games and so on, I think says something about how people are relating to the real world. So I think a really good example of this is when the lockdown first happened, mm-hmm. video game sales soared through the roof. like absolutely soared through the roof. I think some of the figures I was looking at were talking about like 170% increase year on year for the month the previous year. And I think there's two things we can say about that, which I think are both useful. The first is what you're saying is like, there is escapism there. Like people are locked in at home, they can't go and see their friends, et cetera, et cetera. So people are just playing video games. And I think the other thing is like, what are people escaping from? It's like, if you're working a job that you hate and you don't get to do things that feel useful, you know, you get frustrated with your job, it's like loads of games provide people with like a rule-based system where you can escape from the world and you can achieve something. And for most of us in our like day-to-day lives, you go to work, it's difficult to feel like you're doing something useful, you know, working towards something. So I think there's a real kind of, for want of a better term, work is really, really alienating, and video games give people a way to kind of plug into something where they can, you know, they can feel like they're making some progress, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. And absolutely the notion of if this is a form of escapism, what are you escaping from? And that's the thing that we should always pay a lot more attention to. I mean, listen, I'm just kind of posing these questions because I think they're worth talking about. I don't want anyone to get the idea that I'm some kind of reactionary who thinks that games are corrupting the youth's mind. Saying that, you know, I am, am I concerned about people kind of logging on to this and logging off from reality? Yeah, sure, to a degree I am. But then again, gaming's not the only thing people do that with. It can be done in multiple ways. Some of us piss about late at night watching videos on YouTube. So there you go. When you should be in bed, or you should be actually writing a report for your union. But there you are. That's another story. So yeah, do you know what I mean? We all have our thing. It's not the logging off thing I have a problem with. It's a kind of that there seems to be a way of, within this industry, and I'd say I'm a casual viewer, nothing more than that, but there seems to be a way of sort of pulling people more and more into a world that you almost don't want to leave. Actually, it reminds me a little bit of this was done in one of the early, in the second series of Red Dwarf. They did this an episode called Better Than Life, which is, yeah, I think you know it, yeah. So just for people who don't, it's an episode about a game that people completely immerse themselves into. And it's basically everything your life isn't. It's great fun. You're really successful. You know, you do these great things. Now, in the novel that was written about the same time, because there was a few Red Dwarf novels too, some of the characters, the Lister character in particular, actually, his body begins to waste away because he spends so long in this game, he never comes out of it. And when he finally does come out, it's like months or a year or something has passed, you know. And he has a particular one where he's involved. He's living in Bedford Falls, you know, the town from It's a Wonderful Life, which is very, very good book. Remember, right? It's very funny. But there seemed to be a comment on that as far back as the late 80s, you know. And I suppose that's what I'm trying to focus on here. Is there a sense of, you know, in the times that we live in, where actually there's a tremendous amount of hope, certainly as far as workers' control and fighting back is concerned. You've already mentioned the IWGB is just one example of a great union. And forming a union in the games industry, or unions entirely, is a great step forward. But is there also perhaps a version that's kind of pushing people further into a far more enjoyable, far more dealable with reality? A virtual reality, whereas your actual reality is terrible, alienating work at best.
I mean, I think this is a good question. And I think, you know, there are a couple of games that I like and I play from time to time. But I do feel that, so one of the things that I really like is to play a short game that has like a narrative experience. You play it, you know, you play it on an evening and you get through it and you're done with it. You know, it might have some kind of interesting kind of message or some kind of interesting plot device or whatever. I love these kind of short games, because a lot of the games like Assassin's Creed, if you were to play that start to finish and do everything in it, you're talking about like dozens and dozens of hours. You know, some of the big games you can play, you know, 100 hours or something, or some of the online games and you never finish. You know, so there you could play every day and just keep kind of plugging away at these things.
Right.
And there's a game that I really like, which is called Destiny 2, which is a kind of an online game. It's very, very well designed. And you can see how some of the gameplay loops have been designed specifically to suck you in. So, you know, there are kind of reward mechanics where if you just play a little bit longer, you know, you get much further, or, you know, the way you get rewards in the game feels like it's been designed, well, in part because it has, by psychologists who understand how gambling sucks people in.
Mm.
Even though in Destiny you're not gambling anything, but, you know, there are a number of games that have these have gambling dynamics built into them so that you spend longer in them. I have this feeling with Destiny where I really enjoy it, I play a little bit of it, and then I have to say, I'm not going to play it anymore, uninstall it, get rid of it, because I know that it could suck me in, you know?
Yeah.
And I think part of that is about what kind of games get made under capitalism. Is a short, interesting experience is not something that a developer is going to get funding to make necessarily. Something that sucks in people for hundreds of hours and convinces them to constantly be buying things in the game and so on. Like, that's what capital wants from the video games industry. You know, it wants these ginormous games that people have been overworked to make that constantly sell you shit. And it, you know, it sucks the creativity out of games in lots of ways because, you know, they have to be bigger. You know, they have to be more engaging.
Yeah, they've got to go another level up, otherwise it could be considered a failure. I mean, that sounds a little bit like a few things, doesn't it? You know,
doesn't it just Cyberpunk 2077? This game has been in development for like almost a decade, give or take, 7 years or something, I think, and has grown and grown and grown and grown in scale. They promised they wouldn't overwork anyone. And this is this amazing phrase, we're not going to have any mandatory crunch. Right. As if, you know, as if you can consent to overwork in those kind of conditions, but whatever.
Yeah.
And of course, they ended up crunching massively for like years, and people have been working weekends for like over a year and so on. And it's sprawling and it's massive and it's, you know, had hundreds of millions of pounds spent on advertising it. You know, every thing I open on my phone at the moment, I like get a Cyberpunk advert sent to me. And the initial, you know, some of the initial reviews of the game are like, well, it's just massive and like it doesn't all fit together and it's buggy and so on. It's like, that's what capital is going to produce, is these games, you know, which are not necessarily fun, short breaks from the real world to let us, you know, escape for a bit and then come back to things. You know, these are things that really want to suck us in. So yeah, I'm blaming capital, you know.
Yeah, well, no, I agree. And that keys into us. You've worded it better to what the point I'm trying to get to, which is while you or me or someone else might consider gaming to be logging off for a short period of time from the real world, the problem is the real world, as in capital and its dominance, will chase you down anyway. It will invade this space. It will commodify, as it has done to so many things, which hopefully we'll discuss in future episodes of this show. You know, for instance, its commodification of punk, or that's just one example. And listeners can spend their time arguing about that before we've even done a show on it, if you like. But yeah, is what I mean. They come in, you're absolutely right there. They'll come in, they'll try and sell you more things. They'll try and improve the experience, which really just means improving their profit. They will, you know, bring in a huge number of workers who they lash to a point of exhaustion in order to make sure this thing gets out at an allotted time. Not to mention, as you've just said, you end up doing that and one, the game ends up taking nearly a decade anyway. You might as well just designed it yourself. So yeah, that's what I mean there, is that I don't think that, I suppose that's what annoys me about the idea of logging off and relaxing, is that like, what made you think you could do this? You know, this is look at the reality of what's actually going on in this industry.
But I think, you know, I think this comes to a kind of an inconvenient truth for the video games industry, that is, the birth of the video games industry comes around from people who were meant to be working. So often in the military industrial complex in the US, so meant to be like making missile trajectories for, you know, bombing the world or whatever kind of horrible thing they were meant to be planning with computers at the time. And people who were hired because they were technically skilled then thought, well, they've given us these top of the line computers. They want us to do these jobs. in fact, what we're going to do is find a way to muck about and play games with each other. Mm. And this kind of history of video games is one that is kind of inconvenient for capital, but is also where capital exploits and produce, you know, steals value from people. Is, you know, there are the creativity of people and the kind of games that they make is something that capital latched onto and then sold them back to people. And there are some fantastic examples of like what people do who are not being paid, you know, making modifications for games, you know, building whole communities around things, which then companies find a way to close down, to resell, to make money from. And I think it's that kind of radical history of games that I think is the exciting bit. So, I mean, when I was writing Marks of the Arcade, so my dad is a software engineer. And I asked him about this. I'm obviously wasn't saying that he was in that first round of people making video games, because that would make him much older than he actually is. But, you know, when he was a student, I said, you know, did you ever do anything like this? And he told me this really nice story of, you know, him and some other students were meant to be writing an industrial calendar. So for like machinery, to make sure machinery was being used as much as possible. So this was like one of their assignments as students. And instead they found a way to get this, what would now be quite an ancient computer, to play a golf game. And so they, like, you know, because, yeah, it used paper and not a screen, so it's quite ancient. But it was to kind of, you know, to track the trajectory of a ball, and then people could have a go and how much force you put in and so on. And they never sold it. They never shared it with other people. But they did it because it was more fun than the work they were meant to be doing. Yeah. And he said, you know, there are loads of stories of people he knew who did similar things. And so, you know, I'm fully in favor of people finding a way to play video games at work, of doing whatever boring thing their boss is telling them to do. It's like, that's the logging off that we should support. Because part of it's about what we could use technology for differently. Is originally people were misusing military computers just to do something that was fun. And I think that, you know, gives us a sense of like, what else could we do with the technology that we have to use at work? You know, are there other things we could be doing with it? Sure, playing games, mucking around, having fun, but also there are like other things we could do if we had control over technology. And so I think games are a part of that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And certainly that's where I would hope this is being taken. You know, if nothing else, just basically waste your boss's time and money. That's the best thing you can do at work most of the time. So coming back to Assassin's Creed Syndicate specifically, I want to talk just briefly about... So Karl Marx is in this game, as we've talked about. Let's talk a little more in detail about how his place in the game. So it seems to give him pretty good space, I think. He gets to make some speeches. He comes across as a strong, dedicated character who believes in, you know, the things that he believes, what little of his beliefs are actually included in the game. If, as I say, from what I've seen of it, it seems to be that the main characters have at least some level of respect for his dedication. Do you think he gets a good hearing in Assassin's Creed?
I think he gets a bit of a, yeah. And, I particularly like the fact that his worker focus stuff gets a good hearing. Mm. Because, you know, I think it popularizes a little bit of Marx to maybe some people. You know, I think that's a good thing. And as you say, like, maybe some people go away and think, you know, who was that guy? What was he talking about? And so on. I mean, one of the problems is once you finish the missions, you know, he asks you if you want to join the workers' party. And you're not given an option. You know, they just say, we're moving on to the next thing. So you think, you know, missed opportunity. You do get to then change the costume for the characters into a red costume, though.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a bit of kind of, you know, you can do some Marxist cosplay in the rest of the game based off that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. I want a little more out of it than that, but that's a good place to start. So he seems to get, you know, some element of a good hearing to a degree in the game. Do you know of any other games that feature something, you know, Marx, either Marxist or Marx-ish?
That's a good question. I mean, I think there's a long-running series of games called Civilization. Mm-hmm. I think we're up to number 6 now, maybe more. And these always have, basically you control an entire society from hunter-gatherer to spaceships or whatever. And, you know, there are, you can choose what kind of, you know, is it a monarchy? Is it, you know, when do you become democratic and so on? But obviously, I mean, you still control everything. So it's a bit of a kind of moot point, some of that stuff. But there's always a communist option in the Civilization games. And often what communism means there is it's usually like produces tanks faster and like gets more grain. A kind of pastiche of Stalinism, you know, like you'll get a lot of tanks and you get to like take grain out of Ukraine. Because obviously, if you were to have like a revolution in that game, you would no longer be the one controlling everything because you are essentially the dictator in the game.
Yeah.
So, you know, that for the game player, it wouldn't be that fun, really. Like, you'd be deposed and then the virtual workers would run everything instead. So, you know, it would kind of end as a game, I guess. So, you know, there aren't many, unsurprisingly, like representations of Marx or Marxism. Yeah, I'm kind of racking my... I mean, there's Command and Conquer has a kind of hilarious Stalin-esque terrible live-action videos that go along with one of the games. But it's real, like, pantomime Stalinism, you know?
Yeah.
Rather than anything progressive. So, yeah, I think, you know, I think this is a rare appearance for Marx in Assassin's Creed, which, you know, is unsurprising, really, hey? Like, the people who are commissioning these games are not going to be a fan of Marx.
This is the thing I was saying to you before we started, of course, which is that doing some research on this game as best I could, I couldn't actually find out much about the writers or the designers or whose idea it was. And I suppose what I mean, this is something I was going to kind of leave for the closing, but I don't see any reason not to say it now. Ultimately, in this game, I think it's great that Karl Marx is in this game, but to be honest, I don't think there's any great commitment to putting him in. I think he's just another historical figure, like the two Charlies, that you can just pop into the game from that period and make something out of. I don't feel like there's any great commitment from the people that designed it. But like I say, I could be wrong. If listeners know any better about who was, you know, instrumental in putting Karl Marx in Assassin's Creed Syndicate, then please let us know. I'd love to know where I'm more details. I'd love to know if I'm wrong. But it seems like they've just kind of popped him in there because he's like, oh, this guy was alive about that time and he was in London. Let's just stick him in.
Yeah, totally. And I think the interesting thing about a game that scale is like everything is going to have been made by committee. Mm. You know, there won't have been one person who was like, these are all the historical figures that we're going to have. I mean, there's a story that I came across when I was writing the book where there was one person who said that they were basically responsible for putting bird shit on roofs in London because there are so many roofs, you need someone to do the placement of pigeons and bird poo and lampposts. So like when you have that many people trying to craft a world, it may be that somebody put it in there because they were going through a list of historical figures and they just put him in and someone else was told to figure out the missions. And then that person, you know, did some Wikipedia and figured out, or maybe that person was a Marxist and thought, you know, this is my time to put in the stuff about factory reports. It's like,
my time has come.
Yeah, finally I can, you know, I can do this. But you know, there is a history in video games of developers putting in things that they shouldn't. So I mean, there's a couple of examples of early games where people weren't credited, so they would build a secret level and then, you know, put a message in there. There's been a couple about people complaining about overwork and kind of hiding it in the game. So those kinds of interventions that management didn't really want are not unheard of in video games. So I would like to believe that the Marx intervention is a little form of resistance, but I've got no evidence for it, John.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hold out a torch for that because it sounds cool. Yeah, I agree with you. I quite like that idea that someone's dropping little things in, and there's maybe like some underneath subtext of some of these games where, or this one in particular, where it's hoping you will maybe they couldn't kind of prioritize Karl Marx in this game any specifically, but you know, they've given him a good whack as best they can. You never know, we could be wrong. I'm also interested just in the thing of the... So if we move on to talk about kind of politics and culture in games in general, I'm interested in, firstly, the Knights Templar, which comes loaded with a fair bit of historical baggage. So do they run throughout the whole series of the games?
Yeah, so this is like long overriding narrative that connects them all together. That's like the assassins that your player is part of are fighting a kind of battle with the Templars throughout the whole of history. So you go to these different kind of moments, and then there are, you know, they put people in these historical moments on one side or the other. So yeah, you know, luckily Marx is on the good side, not the bad side in Assassin's Creed Syndicate. But, you know, it's a kind of totally nonsense, high concept storyline that basically just allows the games to be set in different time periods. And, you know, I think, you know, that kind of broader narrative is one of like, you know, the bad guys want to control people, the good guys want to free people from oppression, which is that kind of like long running, you know, there's an ability for like, that to become depoliticized, you know, like we're on the side of freedom, you know, it's not an uncommon narrative in the US, you know.
No, that's true. I would say one thing though. I am struck by one comment coming, kind of bridging what we're talking about here, what we were just talking about, which is in the, you mentioned earlier, Karl Marx being very anti-violence in this game, trying to stop one worker who's trying to get revenge against an employer who's responsible for the death of his son. And he makes the comment, democracy is the only way towards socialism. Now, that could just be a line they've dropped in there for Karl Marx to say, because like he would, wouldn't he? But I don't know. I'd like to think that the person who wrote that maybe meant it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is like particular pulling out of something for Marx. It's like Marx certainly didn't believe that voting was the only route to liberation, but at various points argued for involvement in bourgeois elections.
Yeah.
You know, Marx also famously says, you know, any attempt to take guns from workers must be frustrated, however possible. The idea of Marx the pacifist is, you know, not totally bound up, hey. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a particular period, I guess, of Marx that they're trying to pull out there, which, you know, I think part of it is to try and make him look like a bit of a good guy in a weird way. Because, I guess it's trying to fit him into that narrative of, like, he's on the side of these freedom fighters and not on the side of, like, controlling Templars or whatever. So it's kind of odd. You could imagine that they would have pitched Marx as, like, you know, Marx just wants to have a totalitarian regime or something. You know, that would be the, like, more common bourgeois interpretation, you know?
Yeah. And also, I think it's important just to answer, I know no one's asked us this question yet, but in case somebody does, in regards overt politics in games. You might remember this, mate, I can't actually think of it, but isn't there one recently that's come out or is being released, and it's like one of the Splinter Cell, Call of Duty, militaristic wank games, which has Reagan in it, talking about sending people into Latin America.
Yeah, this is the latest Call of Duty, and it's that's like, what's the phrase, pure ideology.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's like no other real way to describe it. I mean, I have a problem with that game, that series of games. For a start, I'm always keen to say we shouldn't kind of condemn these games and we should think through them and so on. But like Call of Duty, the weapons used in the game are licensed from gun companies. So if you buy a copy of Call of Duty, some of your money goes to the publisher. And then some of your money goes to like Heckler and Koch or Beretta or, you know, like big arms companies. And so I think as a lifelong anti-war activist, like I don't want to buy Call of Duty and put money into the hands of companies that like actually kill people, as well as it having terrible politics, you know?
Yeah. And again, I mean, that, no, there's no argument there about whether games are political. That's the most overt example right there. They absolutely are.
Yeah, and I mean, the period that they're going through is like, you basically intervene in like the Contras, like help Reagan to like crush leftist movements and like support war crimes. It's basically a war crime simulator.
Yeah, completely.
But, you know, the American military has had close ties with the video games industry, as we talked about earlier, but, like, also the film industry, hey?
Oh, like, yeah.
The pushing of imperialist narratives through video games, like, shouldn't be a surprise. It's, like, happened in the film industry for decades and decades and decades, you know?
Yeah, and I think this is a great example of why the left need a place in gaming, where, among other things, whether I have any interest in playing them or not is totally irrelevant. Because that space is wide open, and the other side is absolutely going to take it and have done, and are creaming a profit out of it, and are using that profit to do terrible things around the world. So we need a big conversation, but more importantly, action, in which we decide, or everyone decides, what you want to do with games, how you want to be involved with them, where any future profits could go. Yeah, this, I think we're kind of building another show on top of this, I think, with all this. But I think you get where I'm coming from, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, with a lot of games, I think there's a real use for, like, you know, you can use these as a jumping off point to talk about politics. Because I think, you know, video games, for example, are a really good way of talking about, like, how production has changed.
You
know, how, you know, for you to play Assassin's Creed, like, how many forms of labor that relies upon, and global connections and logistics chains across the world and so on. It's like games are like a way in to talk about capitalism today. And I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff in video game communities of, like, the left just want to say that, like, this game is problematic or we shouldn't play it. And I think there's a positive critique we can make of, like, think about how your gameplay, you know, helps you understand the world, or, you know, helps think about how people relate to each other and so on. And then there are games like Call of Duty, where I think we actually have to say, like, this is trash, and you shouldn't give money to gun companies. But that helps you also then to think about, like, what, you know, why we uncover those relationships, what they mean, and that games, like, are part of the real world, you know? They're not set apart from it. Like, if your money goes to a gun company, like, that's having a real world impact, you know?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, completely agree. Right, well, I suppose just sort of more broadly, is there anything else you want to add to our discussion of Assassin's Creed Syndicate?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one final thing, which is just to say that, you know, I think the left, for a very, very long time, hasn't taken video games seriously. And by seriously, I don't mean, like, we all go away and play loads of games. I mean, like, is able to say something about them and understand them in a way that the left did about other cultural forms, you know, engage seriously with them, considered the possibilities around them, alternatives could look like, or all of these kinds of things. And I think this has allowed many video game communities to be influenced by the right and the far right in lots of ways. And, you know, in some senses, the alt-right, particularly in the US, has grown through its connection to and radicalization of online communities, of being somewhere to test out these ideas and develop them and build confidence and so on. And so I think, you know, the risk with video games is not that if the left doesn't take them seriously, we, like, miss an opportunity or something, is that other people are interested in video games. And a lot of those people are interested in them not to talk about how society can be different, how people could have control over their lives, but to push something much more dangerous, which, you know, I'm not saying there's a line from video games to Trump's election, but there's certainly a line from some of those communities to emboldened street demonstrations to a kind of renewed far right, which I think is something to be taken seriously, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. And also, we know games have been used overtly as military recruiting tools in the past. I can't remember the name of the game,
exactly.
But I know there was one sort of around the time that the Iraq war was really going down and they were losing recruits. And there was, you know, an attempt to get more involvement from people via a game that I can't remember the name of the game, but you know,
America's Army is one of them.
That's probably the one I'm thinking of, actually. So thank God you're here. otherwise, yeah. I mean, I suppose I'll just end with a couple of slightly more jolly extras that I picked up in my research about this. One thing I found out is apparently the film director and writer John Carpenter is a keen gamer, and I think he rather likes Assassin's Creed. And hopefully in future episodes, he's going to become quite a major player on this show, because he's very much in the film world, somebody I want to cover. I did see a YouTube comment that made me laugh, actually, when looking at some of this. And somebody said that it represented Sesame Street marks, which I thought was quite cool. And said that the simplicity of the game is probably what Jordan Peterson watched before he had his supposed debate with Slavoj Žižek. That's about the greatest grasp of Marxism he's got, which is odd, really, considering we've generally agreed that he comes across quite well in the game. But there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's never going to be perfect, eh? And I think I'm, super keen to get a good reading of Marx in the game, because I was just so excited about it. So, I see that. But when I hear Sesame Street Marx, I just think of Groucho Marx. So maybe I'm, maybe I'm getting confused too.
Yeah, well, another great Marxist of a type, let's be honest. We need him on the cultural front. I heard a story the other day, actually, that he didn't get... he was called by the Chicago 7 to their trial hearing, and he'd said, "I completely support everything you've done, but I don't think I should attend a hearing because I'm worried that the judge will look unfavourably upon me because of my name." Classic bit of Groucho. Yeah.
Nice.
Okay, well, I think that more or less does it for this episode. So we have been discussing Assassin's Creed Syndicate, 2015 game in the franchise, which featured the big daddy Karl Marx. Have you got anything to add?
I mean, I think, people should definitely play through and see what you make of Marx in the game itself. But, I also think this is, it's about politics shouldn't just be about talking about big P politics. Like, we should have stuff to say about games. And I think this provides a good jumping off point to do that,
Yeah, totally agree. And what you could also do is start a campaign where you boycott, or not boycott, but barrack Ubisoft or whatever, to give you a version of this game where at the end you can join the Workers' Party.
Yeah, add that option, not just the red costume, hey?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Not just a surface value, figurative gesture, but an actual, straight up, you join the movement. Yeah, you could change history, why not? Okay, Jamie, thank you for your time on the show. We will be back with you whenever we can to record another show about Marx at Play. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
You've done a great service for the workers of London. I'm confident the reforms we seek cannot be far over the horizon. I don't suppose you'd formally join the Workers' Party.
I'm not much for politics.
He's not much for anything that requires deep thought.
Does that mean you'll join, Comrade Evie?
I'm afraid I have other responsibilities.
Honorary memberships, perhaps.
You don't give up, do you?
We seem to have that in common. Auf Wiedersehen, my friends.